The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we're commemorating the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. holiday with a little history, some context, some contemporary questions about race in America, and some powerful music.
Just try to do my very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest, 'cause everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn!
That is Nina Simone performing Mississippi Goddamn at the Westbury Music Fair on April the 7th, 1968, so just 3 days after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
If you have been moved at all, and you know my songs at all, for God's sakes, join me. Don't sit back there. The time is too late now. Good God. You know, the king is dead. The king of love is dead.
Nina Simone, along with Sam Cooke and Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger and countless others, made important contributions to the rich canon of protest songs during the civil rights movement. A canon so strong that the term protest song often conjures up images of artists from the 1960s. Well, the tradition did not stop there. However, it just sounds a little different today. Justin Charity is a staff writer for Complex magazine and is here to talk about what protest sounds like in 2016. Justin Charity, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So what have been some of the big notable protest songs of 2015?
Well, I think the biggest, obviously, has been Kendrick Lamar's All Right, one of the singles from his latest album, To Pimp a Butterfly. I know that outside of hip-hop, you sort of have Prince swung through Baltimore during the protests in the wake of Freddie Gray's death. And he also released a song called Baltimore, which is essentially a protest sort of peaceful record in the wake of those protests. And you have Janelle Monáe and her Wonderland Records having released a song called The Hell You Talking About.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Kendrick Lamar's All Right. Now, this track is off his critically acclaimed album, To Pimp a Butterfly. He wrote this in response to the Ferguson protests. And a warning here, it does contain strong language, including the N-word.
Won't you please believe when I say, when you know we've been hurt, been down before. Nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. Nigga, I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright, alright, nigga, we gon' be alright.
While we wouldn't call that one subtle, there are others that are a lot more blunt. Here is What the Hell You Talking About. This is a track from Janelle Monáe you mentioned, featuring several of the artists from her Wonderland Records imprint.
Freddie Gray, say his name! Freddie Gray, say his name! Freddie Gray! Won't you say his name? Ayanna Jones, say her name. Ayanna Jones, say her name. Ayanna Jones, say her name. Ayanna Jones, won't you say her name? Sandra Bland, say her name. Sandra Bland, say her name. Sandra Bland, say her name. Sandra Bland, won't you say her name? Say her name. 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 Won't you say her name?
So she's asking us to say the name of many people who were killed by police, but she goes way back to Emmett Till and those who were killed during the civil rights movement of the 1960s. So, Justin, what do you think? Are these songs a reflection of the Black Lives Matter movement, or have they actually helped build it?
I think it'd be more accurate to say that they're a reflection of Black experiences and that they are compatible with the Black Lives Matter movement. But different artists, I think, relate to the Black Lives Matters movement as a specific protest brand to varying degrees. But I mean, I think it's if you're black in America, I think the past 4 years in particular has made it pretty much impossible for you to be a black artist and have not been at some point frustrated enough that you feel that you pretty much have to make a record that addresses what a huge swath of your audience fears about what's going on in America right now in terms of police brutality.
Kendrick Lamar's All Right has actually become a bit of an anthem. Here it is being chanted at a protest in Cleveland. Well, you said it's impossible not to be affected by this, but clearly not every black artist has put out a protest record. Is there a risk or a fear of backlash to writing a protest song?
Well, I think that let's look at hip hop specifically for a second. I think a big part of, if you compare Kendrick Lamar's generation to, let's say, the early 90s, right, when you had entire rap acts that were sort of, I guess, associated with protest. You can think of KRS-One, you can think of Public Enemy, you can think of Paris. And I think with hip-hop as a genre, used to be, I think in general, a genre that was focused more on telling and less on showing. And I think that in the 21st century, rap has become sort of immersive in the way that rappers talk about police brutality or the way that rappers talk about life in the projects is a bit more immersive, and it's less, you know, this is my song about police brutality, this is my song about racism in America, so much as it's just that their songwriting demonstrates this inequality in a bit more subtle ways. So it's not a surprise that a song like All Right exists, other than that it sort of resonates with the Nina Simone record you played at the top of the broadcast, the Mississippi Goddamn. It's sort of like All Right is the first rap record in a long time that's made me think of the fact that black music in general, outside of hip-hop, just has a very consistent thread of explicit sort of confrontational protest about it that's especially valuable in 2016.
Nina Simone was very clear that Mississippi Goddamn basically got her blacklisted, in her words, from the music business. Kendrick Lamar, he's been embraced by the critics. He leads the Grammy nominations, 11, including Album of the Year for To Pimp a Butterfly. So is that surprising to you?
You know, it is. I think that's true about Kendrick Lamar's album in general, and it's certainly true about, I think, the critical acclaim for All Right, right? It's sort of like you have black people, you know, black fans, black critics, white fans, white critics, sort of universally embracing this music. And for sure, that's not something you necessarily would have seen in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s. But I also think it has a lot to do with maybe just the difference in how artists make music and distribute it, and sort of the power of audiences to organize against musicians when they say things that we don't agree with or don't like.
Say the word protest song and you might think of Bob Dylan or Sam Cooke. Well, some say that we're in the midst of a new civil rights movement. So we're talking with Justin Charity of Complex Magazine about what the new protest song sounds like. Here is a clip of Killer Mike. He's the hip-hop artist from Atlanta. He's taking the stage here in St. Louis. Now, this is an hour and a half after the Ferguson grand jury decision.
I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and something said, just look for something Martin King might have said. So I Googled Martin King, and Wikipedia popped up, and he was 39 years old when you motherfuckers killed him. He was the same age as I am, the same age as Elle. He was a young man when they killed him. But I can promise you today, if I die when I walk off this stage tomorrow, I'm gonna let you know this. It is not about race. It is not about class. It is not about color. It is about what they killed him for. It is about poverty. It is about greed. And it is about a war machine. It is about a war machine that uses you as a battery. So I might go tomorrow. I might go the day after. But the one thing I want you to know, it is us against the mother machine. Let's go.
Killer Mike there, Catching Fire. And this is a video that went hyper-viral. A lot of people have seen it. And I can't help but think about, you know, when Public Enemy was making records, or certainly NWA was making records in the late 1980s, early 90s, there was a lot of hand-wringing about talking about police brutality or, you know, radicalism. But now we have evidence from body cams, from dash cams, from forensic experts, from people who've taken videos on the sidewalk that point to real inequality. Is there a wider audience now for the protest song?
I think there are. I mean, I think sort of like if you compare, let's think back to like NWA instead of how the LAPD tried to handle NWA. It's just sort of they tried to, for a while, just write them off. And I think, you know, the way I think that the United States government and sort of white consumers used to look at this is like, well, you can marginalize these artists. You cannot play them on radio. Get their albums banned from physical cassette and CD retailers, and that'll basically starve the politics out of these groups. And you compare that to Killer Mike now, and I think as much as Kendrick Lamar's All Right has become this critically acclaimed popular record, I think the more interesting story is Killer Mike, because he's not a guy who I think prior to last year that anyone would have associated with conscious hip-hop, right? Like, he's not a guy whose entire style of rapping is oriented around enlightenment. Killer Mike is a very, in some ways, he's a conventional rapper from Atlanta who makes a lot of exciting, dirty Atlanta rap, who also has this political awareness in his real life that I think at this point he just can't help but incorporate into his music. I think the fact that someone like Killer Mike, who's not necessarily a conscious rapper, quote-unquote, is that frustrated on that stage in St. Louis, I think that shows where hip-hop might be going in terms of rappers. You know, there's maybe some hint of a trend in the fact that even rappers that you wouldn't typically associate with political expression are feeling a bit radicalized.
And now he's stumping for Bernie, right?
Yes. That is like such a great trajectory. It's like Killer Mike goes from being, again, a pretty hardcore Atlanta rapper to still being a hardcore Atlanta rapper while making videos with Bernie Sanders and going to his rallies. And doing so is like a credible, it's not like this isn't a Sister Soldier type situation. Like, Killer Mike is a credible guy to take the podium before Bernie Sanders goes on stage. And he's a credible guy to talk to a crowd of several thousand people about why Bernie Sanders is a great Democratic candidate for president.
Well, Justin Charity, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Justin Charity is a staff writer at Complex Magazine, and you can find a playlist of all the songs we've mentioned and more at wordofmouthradio.org.
First they stole our bodies.
I can't cry no more.
Then they stole our sons.
I can't cry no more.
Then they stole our God.
I can't cry no more.
And gave us new ones.
I can't cry no more.
Then they stole our beauty.
I can't cry no more.
The comfort in our skin.
I can't cry no more.
And then they gave us duty.
I can't cry no more.
Well, today we're celebrating Martin Luther King Day with a look at his life and legacy. And we turn now to a page of King's life that is largely unknown. Matthew Sherman brings us the story.
The names of many of Martin Luther King Jr.'s associates are well known. Harry Belafonte, Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young. But one of his most important confidants, a Jewish businessman from New York named Stanley Levison, has remained largely hidden from public view. From what we know about him, Levison probably would have wanted it that way. Martin Luther King met Stanley Levison sometime in 1956. King was just coming off of the successful bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. One of King's biographers, David Garrow, says the civil rights leader would come to New York frequently to raise money.
He had supplicants of all flavors and stripes.
Levison was different. He was in his mid-40s, almost 20 years older than King, and had gotten comfortably wealthy off of a Ford dealership and a string of laundromats.
Levison clearly appealed very powerfully to King as someone with both political and business and financial savvy, someone who knew his way around New York.
Clarence Jones, a black lawyer, began working with King in the early 1960s. He says Levison was a man of medium height with a slight paunch. He always wore a suit and always had a cigarette in his hand.
There was hardly ever a time I was with him, whether it was in a restaurant, whether it was sitting in his home. He was the classic definition of a chain smoker.
Jones was at first surprised to find a white man like Levison near the top of the civil rights movement. Then he understood.
There is nothing that Stanley wanted or needed from Dr. King except maybe nourishment of his soul.
The two of them, Jones and Levison, anchored King's New York operations. They helped King with his speeches. In 1963, they took part in planning the March on Washington.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
I mean, he was a craftsman.
Andrew Young, who'd go on to become mayor of Atlanta, says Levison was particularly good at writing fundraising letters.
They were very short, declarative sentences.
But Levison was valued most for his steady mind.
He was one of the most rational and logical people we had, and our problem was keeping people from going crazy.
It was during the run-up to the 1963 March on Washington that a piece of Levison's past resurfaced and complicated his involvement. Jones recalls that King and other civil rights leaders had a meeting at the White House.
President Kennedy asked Dr. King to please come out of the meeting and take a walk with him in the Rose Garden. And he said, I have some very bad news for you, or some news that's very disturbing.
Kennedy said the FBI suspected Levison was a Soviet agent. King wasn't convinced and demanded to see proof. But when Levison heard the news, he worried that he'd end up ruining the very movement he was trying to help.
Stanley's immediate reaction was, you tell Martin that he has to immediately separate himself from me.
Levison had been under surveillance by the FBI for a decade by that point. Biographer David Garrow says Levison got involved in the Communist Party in the mid-30s.
Stan's role, secret role, with the party, certainly during the late 1940s and early 1950s, was as one of the party's top financial managers.
Garrow says FBI documents show that Levison left the party in about 1956. The Soviet invasion of Hungary that year disillusioned a lot of American communists.
They felt significantly betrayed by the behavior of the Soviet Union relative to what they had thought the ideals of the communist movement were supposed to be.
Levison had grown up in the Rockaways. He wasn't religious, but, Garrow says, he identified as a Jew. He was active in the American Jewish Congress, whose mailing list he used for much of King's fundraising. Jones, the lawyer, says King knew blacks had to get white Americans on board if his movement would succeed.
Of that white majority, the most important constituent part of that white majority was the Jewish community.
Many Jews were sympathetic to the civil rights movement, given their own history of persecution.
Let my people go.
Andrew Young.
There has always been a natural kinship with the Jewish community. I mean, the movement was Jewish in the sense that our songs were Tell O Pharaoh to Let My People Go, Joshua Fit the Barrel of Jericho.
Let my people go.
King and Levison suspected, rightly as it turned out, that Levison's phones were tapped and he was under surveillance. So they would pass messages through Clarence Jones.
Dr. King would say to me, will you have an opportunity to see and talk with our friend? And I will say, oh, absolutely.
King knew that maintaining contact with Levison was politically risky. Newspapers carried occasional stories about the alleged communist infiltration of the civil rights movement. But despite the risks, King at times felt he just had to talk to Levison directly. Garrow says the FBI captured hundreds of conversations between the two men.
Some of which involve the most mundane aspects of civil rights movement fundraising, others of which involve quite pressing crises.
And next I want to introduce you, Dr. Martin Luther King.
What should King say about President Johnson? What should King say about events in Vietnam?
We will no longer vote for men who continue to see the killing of Vietnamese and Americans as the best way of advancing the goals of freedom
In the years following King's assassination in 1968, Levison continued his involvement in the civil rights movement. He helped Coretta Scott King establish the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change, and he raised money for Andy Young's congressional races. Levison died in 1979 at the age of 67.
And that story came to us from Matthew Sherman.
Walls came tumbling down, hallelujah. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each year, we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day with clips from the Reverend Doctor's powerful speeches. We see footage of protesters in Birmingham sprayed by fire hoses and set upon by dogs, or white residents taunting students walking to school in Little Rock. What we don't see is Dr. King leading tens of thousands on a freedom march through Boston in 1965 to protest segregation in the city's housing and schools. We rarely revisit the race riots in Detroit or tanks rolling in Newark or that piercing photo of a Boston mob attacking a prominent black attorney with an American flag on a pole. For many Northeast residents, ideas of slavery and segregation are distinctly Southern. The North is progressive, after all, the seat of the abolitionist movement, the Harlem Renaissance, the place where Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier and where jobs, homes, and opportunity were on offer for those fleeing the Jim Crow South. UNH history professor Jason Sokol identifies some big gaps between the North's political liberalism and abject bigotry. He's here to talk about the conflicted soul of the Northeast, as covered in his book, All Eyes Are Upon Us. And Jason Sokol, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you focus on Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York as the seats of the Northern Mystique. What is the Northern Mystique?
The Northern Mystique is a belief, as you alluded to, the fact that the North has been this center of political liberalism, cultural enlightenment, and racial progressivism. And, you know, I think this is, to some extent, this has been a myth that the North is better than the South. But I think at times, Northerners' beliefs that they are capable of certain breakthroughs have sort of propelled them forward in a way when, for instance, the South has sometimes been held back. But I focus on Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York because I think they're most often associated by many people as being the heart of this progressivism and liberalism.
I'd love to dig into that sort of self-regard as being colorblind and how that notion of being free from bigotry influenced the fight for racial equality in the North.
The idea that they were colorblind, many white Northerners adhered to this, believed that they didn't really see color and contrasted themselves with white Southerners who they thought were clearly bigots and segregationists. Now, that belief in colorblindness actually cut both ways during the civil rights era. On the one hand, when you look at politics, for instance, white Northerners could actually vote for African-American candidates. For instance, Ed Brooke was the first black senator elected since Reconstruction. He was elected by Massachusetts voters in 1966. Part of all the rhetoric of that campaign was that voters in Massachusetts were colorblind, and Brooke played into that to get in part to get elected. On the other hand, Massachusetts voters thought that they were colorblind, and when you apply that to things like schools and housing, you know, school officials, school committee officials said, well, we're colorblind, we just assign students to whatever neighborhood they're in. Well, that produced racial segregation, and it fed and accelerated and worsened that segregation. So in that realm of life, schools and housing, this supposed colorblindness merely increased segregation and deepened racial inequality.
Well, as you point out, the idea of being colorblind or progressive helped at least create a sense of what could happen. As one writer put it, it created a greater responsibility to racial progress. So what did that mean for African Americans living in the Northeast? You know, these big leaps in ideas of racial progress followed by on-the-ground backlashes, which I think you illustrate very well in the story of Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson's Brooklyn. Tell us that story.
Well, at certain moments, this widespread belief in colorblindness could create an opening in which African Americans could actually break through that opening and achieve certain types of progress that weren't possible elsewhere. And 1947 was the year when Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers. You know, when I started researching this story, I had to remind myself, 1947, that's almost a decade before anyone had heard of Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks. He was a real pioneer. And Brooklyn was, you know, hailed by many as a real melting pot. And whites in Brooklyn themselves, you know, patted themselves on the back for their ability to embrace and root for Jackie Robinson. Well, you know, that kind of progress only went so far. Jackie Robinson experienced firsthand the vicious housing discrimination when he tried to buy a home not only in New York City, but then when he tried to move to the white suburbs. It took them several years to find any town that would allow, that would sell, any white owner that would sell to a black family, even if that family was Jackie Robinson, the most, you know, the most valuable player in the National League.
Now, not everyone was smugly caught up in this idea or patting themselves on the back about being progressives. The junior senator from Connecticut stood on the Senate floor in 1970 and charged that the North is guilty. Guilty of what, was he saying?
This was Abraham Ribicoff, who was the senator from Connecticut. And 1970, he stood on the floor and he said the North is guilty of racial hypocrisy. And he said, you know, we have as much racism and segregation here in the North as there is anywhere else. White Southerners said, here's one liberal Northerner who finally gets it, who finally understands that the North is just as bad as the South. Here was this liberal Jew from Connecticut who was now a Confederate hero because he finally told the truth. The story got more complicated when one year later, Ribicoff actually proposed a bill that would do what he actually wanted to do. And Ribicoff proposed this bill that was designed to help every urban and suburban school system integrate their schools over the course of a decade. Now, when Ribicoff finally proposed that bill, white Southerners said, hang on a minute. I don't think he's really our hero. We don't really want to go along with this bill.
What you point out is the fall of the North. In 1971, the Supreme Court ruled that busing could be used to achieve racial integration, and Boston became the epicenter of resistance to busing. Now, this was after a lawsuit by the NAACP kind of forced the hand of the judiciary. A few really decisive moments in that fight, including one on September 12th, this is 1974, when an angry mob marched from the Common to Government Center. What happened?
Yeah, this was an anti-busing mob, so it was a mob of thousands of whites in Boston. And Federal Judge Garrity in June had ruled that Boston schools would have to be integrated, and he ruled that students would be bused between different neighborhoods. Now, he paired South Boston with Roxbury, which was an explosive combination,
right,
to say the least. And thousands of whites in Boston were very angry, and they marched to Government Center, and they had a rowdy protest. Ted Kennedy made a surprise appearance at his office there. And he got, you know, basically run down by the mob, which ran up to the windows and stormed the building and broke the glass. There was a lot of anger and hatred and violence in those streets.
So blood was flowing now in the cradle of liberty, right? Now, how was this viewed by the rest of the country?
The rest of the country, to some extent, people were surprised that this was happening in Boston. You know, some people around the country still had this view of Boston and New England as somehow more progressive than other places. White Southerners were euphoric. They wrote many letters to the Boston Globe saying, "See, you guys have had these race difficulties for years. Now it's just chickens coming home to roost, basically." And, you know, the reaction of African Americans around the country was to view Boston as a place they never wanted to go to.
People of color are not safe to come here to Boston, and we're asking people across the country of color to stay away.
And Boston has had that reputation ever since the busing crisis, even before. I mean, Bill Russell, he wrote very passionately about the racism that he faced in Boston in the 1950s and 60s. And then when this happened in the 70s, you know, African-Americans said, I'm not going there. It was viewed as just as unsafe for them as Mississippi.
I have to say, 10 years ago, I did a fellowship, you know, across the river in Cambridge, but two African-Americans and a Latino man, they were terrified of coming to Boston. And I feel like, you know, I thought, oh, that was so long ago. But there is this kind of, how are we implicated, you know, as Northerners, as people who are Northeastern New England folks, in this idea that, oh, that was just a thing of the past. This is over now.
I mean, to the extent that white Northerners still believe that, then I would say, yeah, we're all wrong and we're certainly all implicated until we demand policies that are more aggressive in terms of making our cities and towns more welcoming and more open and more equal places for racial minorities and impoverished racial minorities to live.
Well, you point out, you know, busing is one of those policies that the right and the left could agree, oh, this was just a mess, you know, it was bad. But considering the results and the data, did busing actually successfully integrate Boston schools?
Busing brought a measure of desegregation to Boston schools that would have never come about had busing not been implemented. So, you know, busing brought violence. Busing accelerated white flight from the city, which had already been happening well for decades before busing, but it did accelerate that. But it also integrated some schools that had not been integrated and that would not have been integrated otherwise.
In the introduction, you refer to a speech Dr. King wrote about America being schizophrenic about race, back to the Declaration of Independence. And in your book, it's a place of opportunity on the one hand. You know, Edward Brooke gets elected in Massachusetts, Shirley Chisholm in Brooklyn in the 1960s. Decades later, Deval Patrick paving the way for Obama's election. And yet, hours after Barack Obama is elected, first Black president of the United States, the Macedonia Church of God in Springfield, Massachusetts, a Black church, was torched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the disconnect here?
Yeah, I think America has always had a commitment to these two conflicting ideals. Call them freedom on the one hand and segregation on the other, or, you know, democracy on the one hand and exclusion on the other. You know, this kind of contradictory legacy still plays out today. And so, you know, one explanation is that there was a backlash against Obama's election and that it was felt in Springfield, Mass., just as it was felt in Deep South states that didn't vote for Obama, where white voters and white Americans saw this great leap forward in America's political history. And they lashed out against it. They realized that the world wasn't theirs to do with as they pleased any longer. And what I mean by that is that, you know, for so long, white Americans had been the vast majority and still hold the vast majority of wealth and power. Well, whites got scared, I think, by Obama's election. And you can still see a lot of that resistance nowadays, and whether it's violence in the streets or whether it's just rhetoric against the president.
How about now, Jason? I mean, I think of Ferguson and Baltimore and Waller County, Texas, you know, places that feel very far away from the circumstances and the temperament of life in the great Northeast. I mean, do these recent cases of police brutality kind of perpetuate the Northern mystique? It doesn't happen here.
Well, Eric Garner, you know, that case happened in Staten Island.
Yeah.
And so I would say that it does happen here. And if people think that it doesn't happen here, well, they're just telling themselves a happier tale than is actually the truth. Because, I mean, these incidents do happen in New England. They do happen in the Northeast. You know, so the fact that the street protests haven't gotten to the level in New England as they have in, say, Ferguson or Cleveland, well, I think they could if you just had an episode with more publicity.
Well, Jason Sokol, enlightening for me anyway. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Jason Sokol, he's assistant professor of history at UNH and author of All Eyes Are Upon Us. You'll find much more on the book and more on Jason at wordofmouthradio.org. On August 28, 1963, close to a quarter of a million people poured onto the Washington Mall to show their solidarity with the growing civil rights movement. It was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and the venue where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his now iconic I Have a Dream speech. But he didn't debut that speech in Washington. King gave an earlier version of the now famous oratory on June 23rd of that same year at the Detroit Walk to Freedom. The event was organized by the Detroit Council for Human Rights, and it was conceived as a way to commemorate the race riot that took place in the city 20 years earlier. But it was also an event to protest the current state of race and economic relations, both in the American South and the urban North. Producer Zach Rosen spoke with a handful of Detroiters who were at that gathering in June of 1963.
I remember it was a beautiful day, and I remember there was this joy everywhere.
It was just all in all a fantastically beautiful day.
And as a 16-year-old, how would you have found out about the protest? Are there posters at record store?
No, no. My friend Mike Evans and I, two of the young ladies we were dating, they knew about it, so we went with them.
I bet you're wondering how I knew.
History is a story. It comes from the word histoire. And as D.H. Carr said, it's a dialogue between the past and the present. Well, I'm Grace Boggs, and I'm an awfully old woman, and I was born nearly 100 years ago. So in 1963, I was 48 years old.
The whole center city of Detroit was being cleared of blacks to make way for urban renewal. The freeway construction had begun, so there was a lot of unrest. I'm Reverend Dr. Nicholas Hood, Sr. I was 40 then.
I'm Ron Scott. I was 16 in 1963. I had had a gun pulled on me and put a shotgun in my face when I was 13 years old as part of the mayor of the city of Detroit's crackdown on crime, which was really cracking down on a number of African Americans. So it was very significant to me.
We started holding meetings in churches once a week to announce the march. And incredibly, the whole state became involved.
My name is Jennifer Nguyen. I was 15 in 1963. And I had a social studies teacher by the name of Miss Norton. She was very strict and she was very conservative. She always wore a dark color and like the old nurse's shoes. And she always would talk about John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. She made an assignment for us to go to the walk. And if you didn't do the assignment, you know, you would fail the class. So, you know, this is in June. It was like, okay, well, you know, I got to go.
Well, I think the struggle for rights had been a struggle for integration, and now we were struggling about what kind of society were we going to have in this country and who was going to lead it.
So I had to walk up to Dexter, take the Dexter bus, and it would take me all the way downtown. That was a 45-minute ride. At that time, you know, you could ride the bus by yourself. You didn't have to worry about anyone trying to kidnap you or say anything bad to you because everyone was very nice at that time. And it was just crowded. I had never seen so many people in all my life. And we just started walking.
I invited our church to join the march with me. And we joined the march at about 1 or 1:30. on that Sunday. They'd already been going, and we walked the 4 or 5 miles of the route, singing all the way, and everybody we saw, even the people on the sides watching, were singing. Much to our surprise, when we arrived at Cobo Hall, there were so many people crowding inside the building that the line of marches where I was were turned down behind Cobo Hall. Crowded, they were all the way to the river.
And were you able to hear what was happening?
No, actually, in all honesty, I didn't get in. They did have speakers, but in those days, the electronics weren't as advanced as they are today.
My good friend, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, and all of the officers and members of the Detroit Council of Human Rights, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot begin to say to you this afternoon how thrilled I am, and I cannot begin to tell you the deep joy that comes to my heart as I participate with you in what I consider the largest and greatest demonstration for freedom ever held in the United States.
To me, it was more significant than the March on Washington because people remember the speeches. There were big shots speaking on August 28th. I mean, it was the organization. It was the involvement of people. It was the connection with the local struggle that was so important.
I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job.
It really wasn't just about that. I have a dream. It really was a march. For instance, that year, 1963, there was a woman who was a sex worker who was killed by the name of Cynthia Scott. She was African American. The cop that killed her was white. And people got very upset about that because she was just kind of wantonly shot down. And they challenged it with that without even raising the question about whether she was a prostitute. She was a human being. Today, in many cases, people want to know, well, was this guy a good guy? Was he a bad guy? The value of human life, I think, has changed to some degree.
We will be able to achieve this new day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of all, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty.
I just remember the fact that Detroit, in its essence, was a place that could help transform the world. And I think that's similarly the case today.
I have a dream. I have a dream. I have a dream. I still have a dream. I have a dream. I have a dream.
And that story came to us from producer Zach Rosen. Well, that's all we have time for today, and I know that I always say thank you for your listening time, and I mean it. Listening is an act of respect, and with all that we have to do on a given day, I believe it is generous to listen to the people in our lives and those far outside of our lives, and to the words of those like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who could shift minds and propel the world beyond its pettiness and limitations. So on this day when we have reason to reflect upon the nature of equality and respect and the many impediments, real and imagined, that keep us from reaching them, I thank you again for your listening time and hope to share much more of it in the future. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.